This is quite an occasion. I've known Brother Clarence Sharp a mere 48 years. But we've never had a harsh word. We've done all kinds of things together. We've worked together, traveled together, met the enemy together, been defeated occasionally, won pretty often. And it's a glorious memory for me and for many of you here. Of course, my first meeting with Clarence in South Dakota upon the occasion of the South Dakota Farmers Relief Conference in Pierre, we are having a conference with more people than are in this room. And somebody got unhappy, thought we were a little too radical, and demonstratively got up, led a bolt from the meeting. This is not a suggestion to anyone here. And the bolt consisted of three people, walked out. We had a 300-pound man named Charlie Red Flag Taylor, who had a voice. He didn't need any loudspeaker. He had a built-in loudspeaker. Charlie rose to say in senatorial tones, "That wasn't a bolt, that was a nut." Well, the guy who led the bolt was a member of the legislature. His name was Moserson. And years later, he encounters Clarence on the street, I think of Aberdeen, maybe. And he says, "Clarence, I'll buy you a dinner. I want to talk to you, all right?" And over the dinner, he says, "Clarence, how in hell did you know that what you were proposing in 1933 would become the law of the land? I thought it was so radical that it was just crazy. And here, most of what you proposed is the law of the land. How'd you know?" I don't know what Clarence answered, but I think he might have answered, "Well, you see, sir, I have a certain advantage. I'm a communist, and that lets me in on all kinds of things. I can read the future." I don't know if he said that or not. Well, I'll indulge in one other pleasant memory, and then you'll have the pleasure of hearing other people. Clarence and I were requested in a manner that didn't permit any no for an answer to start a tour, purpose of which was to gain members of the Communist Party out amongst the small towns. This was during the World War II. Gas was being rationed. Clarence and I set forth in his car. We got about 50 miles from Minneapolis. Clarence says, "Oh, damn," he says, "I forgot to bring the gas stamps with me." Well, then he said, "Oh, it doesn't matter. We'll always be within reach of a farmer comrade. We'll tank up there." Truth of the matter is, we went some 2,000 to 3,000 miles. We never paid a cent for the gas, and things worked beautifully. And purely incidentally, in a very modest way, I will report to you that when we came back and made our report, we said that 23 farmers, as a result of our eloquent efforts, had joined the Communist Party. Okay. Now, Brother Clarence, this is his 90th birthday. And that's something of an achievement, too. If I knew him 48 years, that wasn't the beginning of his convictions of socialism. He was a socialist long before that, and is one today. And he's the kind of a person who encounters the zigzags of economic life, the ups and the downs. I've never seen him discouraged. I never seen him change one bit. And the Clarence you got today is the Clarence you had, I would put it at about let's say 75 years ago, when age 15, he was, the fruit was maturing, I think, about then. And that's the way he stayed. And I think we can take our hats off to Clarence Sharp. Now then, our first treat is Marital Desoer, whom a lot of you know. Now, she has been honored in many ways, and very deservedly. Now, for example, in 1977, she was one of four Minnesota women honored at the Minnesota Women's Meeting at St. Cloud State College for distinguished contribution to the state, the nation, and as though that isn't enough, to the world. The state, the nation would be enough. To the world, too. Now, something else is going to happen in connection with Maridel. In New York this October, and Art Shields, listen to this very carefully. In New York in next October, there will be held for the first time in 40 years a new Writers' Congress. It is being called by the editor of the Nation, and there are meetings being held now to let writers know and to plan panels and all that kind of stuff. The committee starting the Writers' Congress has named Marital Desoer as the honored first speaker to recall the reasons for the Progressive Writers' Congress of 40 years ago, and then they're going to try and carry on the tradition. So she will be performing that role too. Marital, it's your turn.
Friends, comrades, old warriors and new warriors, faces I see here remembered on many picket lines, protest meetings, and struggles, the brothers and sisters who now enter the great struggle of the multinational global struggle of the people, the multinational people. We honor here one of our great teachers, our indomitable organizers, our believers and founders of human solidarity. Amongst those who stood against the moguls of power when it was dangerous and unpopular, and you were tarred and feathered and followed by the FBI and arrested and deprived of a living. I have always seen Clarence Sharpe as a man who went among the people, traveled what some said was equal to three times around the world, just going to North Dakota. Teaching and preaching and walking and distributing literature and persuading and following the plow in the fields, in hundreds of farmhouses, arguing, teaching, persuading. Like my father, Arthur Desoer, used to tell about how they went, this was before the Nonpartisan League, how they went amongst the people. They'd go into a village and get out a leaflet saying we're having a meeting against the grain exchange in the schoolhouse tonight. And they'd ring the bell, and then everybody would come, and he had a big chart which he let down, which showed what the thieves of the grain exchange in Minneapolis and Chicago were doing by the stroke of a pencil, robbing the farmers of millions of dollars by regrading the wheat. And this was the basis of the Nonpartisan League. And for 1 year, North Dakota was like a socialist state. For 1 year, they had the governor and the legislature, and expropriated the mills. And for 1 year, that you had a socialist state within the Midwest capitalism. We honor and learn from him, and it's time for us to learn how they did, how they went amongst the people, how they stood on soapboxes, how they taught and listened and understood the true struggles of the farmers and the people of the Dakotas. They taught us how to always recognize the strength of the people, of the exile, the refugee, of the mortgage and high interest, the violently deprived, the robbed, the rebel. It is these teachers we love. It is they we honor, not the robbers, predators, barons, bosses, financiers, grabbers, despoilers of wood, coal, oil, maggots, we used to call them, the oil maggots, the thieves. He never sold out, never became a cynic, never lost faith in the people, never feathered his own nest, never spy or stool pigeon, or even fence straddler, or surreptitiously eating at the banquet of the vultures. Now in time, we see their heroism come from the strength of our people and our beloved land and our enduring struggle, how he kept it alive in us. I have lived in his time, and I have been like him, a communist in this terrible time of two wars and depressions and McCarthy and the death of the Rosenbergs and the Spanish War and fascism. I know the terrible pressures bearing upon us. One of the greatest journeys of my life I took with Clarence during the McCarthy period into North Dakota, where we were followed, where farm windows had to be raised so the FBI on a clear day couldn't see through 100 miles on the plains into their front rooms. I remember a farmer telling us that you were supposed to go and sit on these towers to watch for the Russians. We were coming over the north. And the FBI came to see him and asked him if he was on the lookout for the Russians. And he said he was just digging in his irrigation ditch. And he said, "No, I'm too busy watching for a Russian submarine coming down my ditch." I remember the meetings we had in farmhouses then. People came for 100 miles to meet in that dark period. And Clarence would have the back of his car filled with workers and pamphlets, and people were waiting to find out. You couldn't get any information then, and people were waiting for Clarence to bring them the pamphlets and the hope and the courage of the struggles of the people. I'll never forget that journey and the new kind of intellectual that I saw there, the Marxist farmer intellectual. The true intellectual in which the theory and the practice are one. I learned then to how to think in true terms of Marxism. Yes, we are here now to celebrate your faithfulness to the battle for our land and our people. We are proud to be with you in the long line of embattled farmers and radicals, and the many radicals that came up out of the furrow, like Clarence Hathaway and Gus Hall, and I couldn't even begin to name the great root radicals from the Middle West who have lighted our struggle. We are celebrating our strength and our beauty in you, Clarence. You have taught us never to forget or never betray this path of the true collective strength of the working class. There is no choice or temptation, I say to you young warriors now who enter this very complicated world. There is only two choices, death or life. There should be no complication. There's no bribe big enough, no security great enough to tempt you off of the path that Clarence and all of our struggles in the past have lighted for you, have shown you. And I ask you to look at the old timers I see here today. I believe it shows me the only way to grow old is to be a radical. They are beautiful looking, aren't they? So if all the seeds that Clarence has planted, when they start to come up in the great socialist crop, look out.
A technical announcement, which I deliberately chose this moment because I did not want in any way to interfere with what Meridel had to say. We have quite a program, and we have asked the speakers to limit themselves to 6 minutes. I'm going to say 1 minute at 5 minutes, and if a speaker becomes enthusiastic and continues, and everybody in this hall starts looking at me in a kind of unfriendly fashion, I will stand in a rather disruptive way next to the speaker, and you know the rest. And this remark is not aimed primarily at the next speaker, who I'm very happy to introduce to you. Next speaker, James Flower, whom I've known. Just a minute, I'm going to say something about you.
He's not
going to speak till I say something. Jim Flower, you should know, has been operating a very long time also, and was in the early day. I don't know if you were the secretary or the president of the United Farmers League.
National secretary,
not just secretary, national secretary. And that was the most progressive farm organization in America, chose him to be their national secretary, and he's a good one too. Well, Jim is going to speak to you of some of his memories, and we're honored to have him.
To make sure that I don't go over the 6 minutes allotted to me, I wrote it. It's a lot of work, by the way, to write a speech. It's much easier just to get up and talk. But I want to start out by saying, dear friends of Clarence and Seagard, it is my hope that the committee who have worked long and hard to prepare this well-deserved tribute to Clarence will forgive me if I include Seagard. They make a great team. And the word came to mind when I realized that the life of our Clarence spans an era from the horse and buggy wagon days of the early 1900s to jet propulsion and nuclear fusion. That's a long time for one man's life to live. In the space of this same life, events have taken place that have no historic equal since man began to keep records of what has and does take place in our world. It is impossible to tell in 5 minutes of the United Farmers League or the activities that it conducted in the years of the Great Depression. I know it was in those years that I first met our Clarence, but I cannot recall if it was at the combined Second National Hunger March and the First National Farm and Rural Workers Conference held in Washington when Hoover was still in office. I do know that about 20 people at the conference were from the United Farmers League. It had been formed at a small farmers conference held in 1928 at New York Mills, Minnesota. On the strength of the fact that we had organized and stopped a particular farm foreclosure sale and its write-up in the old Daily Worker and the Producer's News and a little pamphlet called Party Affairs, if my memory is correct, I was elected to be the National Secretary of the United Farmers League. Suffice to say that of all the people who worked and took part in the struggles in those years, four people have always stood out in my mind. Clarence Sharp and the United Farmers League of Northeastern South Dakota played a real role in their area. They were electing county commissioners and officers and other county officers were active, open supporters of the Communist Party and the United Farmers League. One other was Reno Tantala from the northern woods of Minnesota. Reno died fighting fascism in Spain. Two other people I met in those years were Eric Burt, whose widow is here today, Ruth, who was then the editor of the Producer's News in Plentywood, Montana, and if none of you have ever been to Plentywood, you've missed it. The other was Lem Harris, who is here with us today. And I want to make a confession. I thought so then, and I think so now. I thought it in the 30s, that surely in our movement and in our party, There must be some who were more qualified to be the national secretary of the United Farmers League than I was, just an ignorant farm boy who wanted to fight from rural Minnesota. Some who were better educated, who had more knowledge, and so forth. I thought then, and I think now, that the national secretary of the United Farmers League should have been Clarence Sharp from South Dakota. And Clarence, I want you to know it, I've never said it to you before. Now, in closing, I don't have the time here to touch on all the events that are taking place and so forth, but in closing, I hope that these conferences that the United Farmers League and Lem Harris were the primary organizers of, the Farm and Rural Conferences. We had one in Washington, we had a bigger one in Chicago, we had a still bigger one in Sioux Falls, or in Sioux City, Iowa. I think those Farm and Rural Conferences are a necessity, and they should make every effort to reconvene them and start to hold them again, so that in 1982 at least, or maybe yet in 1981, we're going to have a Farm and Rural Conference in the United States of people concerned with farm and rural affairs. And I can only say to you, Clarence, that our class of people have made great gains in your lifetime and in our lifetime. We have things now that weren't dreamed of, like unemployment insurance and Social Security and many other things in our youth, in our days. And I don't think that the plain, ordinary people are going to stop fighting, or that the romping Ronnies are going to smash in a short period of time all the gains that mankind has made. I don't believe the American people are going to stand for it. I think the same thing will happen to romping Ronnie that happened to the thousand-year Reich of Hitler and Nazi Germany. I think that the romping Ronnies will be done away with by the American people, and we will march forward to socialism. Thank you.
So that you all may be acquainted, may I ask at this moment if Ruth Burt will stand and take a bow from the assembly, the widow of Eric Burt, who went to Montana in a very early day. And when Jimmy Flower says, if you haven't been to Plentywood, Montana, you've missed it, Ruth Burt the other day said that one of the really best years of her life and her husband's life was when they, with considerable hardships, lived in Plentywood, Montana.
There wasn't a tree in the town. I don't know why they called it Plentywood.
If you didn't hear that, she remarked there wasn't a single tree in the town, but the town was called Plentywood. Now we're going to hear from a farm woman activist who has been on the ball for many years and is still doing wonders. I have a personal note to make about Clara Jorgensen. As my children were growing up, I decided that the education they were receiving in the public schools didn't cover the whole ground, needed a little dressing on top of the cake. So both my daughters, in separate years, spent a month on the farm of John and Clara Jorgensen. I'm happy to say that they worked them real hard, at least the children said so, and I think reasonably well, but quite seriously, a month on the Jorgensen farm had a lifelong effect, a very positive lifelong effect on both of my children, and for that I shall always be very grateful. Now you'll hear something from Clara Jorgensen herself.
Honored guests and friends, Today, I want to pay tribute to the forgotten progressive farm woman who, for many reasons, stayed at home. A very dedicated woman who was ready to make real sacrifices in order that her husband could take part in the struggles of the Great Depression, where farmers were concerned, spanned many years. Most men were very helpless taking care of home and children, as that was not supposed to be their domain. That has been a real sore spot with me, where many men in the progressive movement have been so guilty of male chauvinism. Men were also more mobile than women, as most women could not drive in those days. The cost and extra labor for the woman, if her husband was an activist, was almost insurmountable. Taking care of home and children, then garden and field work, besides helping feed the cattle and milk the cows. A full-time job, and then she, and if the children were old enough to help, assumed her husband's work as well. Remember, this was a time when most women had to pump water by hand and carry it to the house for the household, and if she had to wash, it seemed like an unending job. What a nightmare it was to wash, heating water, scrubbing by hand on a washboard, wringing the clothes by hand, many of them very heavy, carrying the wash water out, and hanging clothes outside many times in sub-zero weather, as we had nowhere to hang it inside except at night when we would hang it in the kitchen. The wood also had to be carried in every day to heat the house, and it was no little skill to keep a couple of stoves going, remembering to add wood ever so often, and getting up at night to replenish them so the children wouldn't get cold. And pitching and stacking hay by hand wasn't so hot either. The chickens and egg money were supposed to be the women's so-called pin money, a myth, because strangely it would wound up buying groceries and clothing for the children, for the family. But it was a source of pride to the woman, the only thing that was considered theirs, and they could buy something themselves with what society deemed they had earned, chicken and egg money. And if you think we've come a long way, baby, just listen to this. When we farm women apply for our Social Security, we are all of a sudden dependents of our husband and are given a pittance in Social Security. The government cheating us out of our just due and further eroding our dignity by counting as nothing our contributions to the farm operation. Many, many women gave unstintingly, without complaint, to make it possible for their husbands to leave, so we would be able to draw masses of people to the fight at hand, whether against foreclosures, demonstrations, or meetings to coordinate the giant movements of those times. Whether the woman or the man was the activist, it took money to travel and left even less than ever for the family, which she willingly sacrificed for the good of mankind. A woman activist taking her place in the movement did triple duty, getting so far behind when she was gone in the home and in the fields. It took real organizing to catch up. I remember as one example of Lena Borchardt going down on the evening train to a meeting of the State Central Committee of the Farmer Labor Party after a day's work, and after the meeting was over, taking the midnight train home and arriving at 5 a.m. and went right to work without any sleep. I hope in this short time allotted to me, I have been able to convey to you a little of what these wonderful women did, whether activists or not. These individual contributions made by women helped to make the trickles that created a mighty river in that time, so the people could not be ignored anymore. We need now to make an even mightier river to sweep the warmongers out of office and replace them with men and women like those gathered here today, who have dedicated their lives to bring peace to this world. Thank you.
After that enormous and deserved applause, takes a brave man to make any correction. However, when Clara says that pitching hay isn't so hot, It's my memory that on a hot summer's day in the haymow, spreading around the hay is the hottest job on the farm. Now, there's someone else here that you should greet. He is Clarence Sharps, Sr. He and his wife are here. You're all acquainted with his brother, who died a year or so ago. Tom? No. No? What's his... Jim. There we go. See, the chairman has to know. Jim Shields. And Art Shields and Esther Shields are here now. Please stand up so that everybody can greet you. If there are those who don't know, Art Shields is a journalist, a labor journalist, a specialist in covering the important strikes in the United States of the past half century. We will now have a treat from a wonderful woman, composer of music, singer of songs of militancy and protest. She's well known at this time for composing and singing Irene Paul's, Minnesota woman, now in California, famous marching song, Grandma's Battle Cry. This she will sing at a later time in our program, but right now she will sing a song of her own choice. Stupidly, the chairman didn't say that the person is Barbara Tilson.
This is a song called People Like You. It was written by Cy Conn.
Old fighter, you sure took it on the chin. Where'd you get the strength to go on? Never giving up or giving in. I just wanna shake your hand because people like you help people like me go on, go on. People like you help people like me go on, go on. Old battler with a scar for every town, thought you were no better than the rest. You wore your colors every way but down. All you ever gave us was your best. You know that people like you help people like me go on, go on. People like you help people like me go on, go on. Old dreamer with a world in every thought, how'd you get the vision to keep on? You sure gave back as good as what you got. I hope that through my years to come, they'll say that people like me help people like you go on, go on. Because people like you help people like me go on, go on, go on.
Thank you.
Barbara will sing again with us. There is a farmer here from Swift County, Minnesota. He was an activist in the farm holiday movement of 30, 40 years ago. He's still an activist. When someone asked him, will you come and say a few words, he remarked, I'm just a farmer, what can I do? Well, you know, just a farmer is a very honorary title. If he'd said, well, I'm just a stockbroker, or I'm just an advertising man from Madison Avenue, I'd agree. that we don't want them, we don't need them too much. But just a farmer is the salt of the earth. So let's hear now from Roy Peterson.
Thank you, Lem. It's about 120 years ago since Lincoln wrote the Lincoln Gettysburg, made the Lincoln Gettysburg speech. And this is with apologies to Mr. Lincoln. 63 years ago, our grandfather had helped bring forth...
A little louder, they can't hear in the back row.
Should I start? 63 years ago, our grandfather had helped bring forth upon this planet the First World War. Conceived in the nationalistic fervor and dedicated to the proposition that some people are created more equal than others. Now we are engaged in a vast Cold War, testing whether our nation or any nation so deceived and so frustrated can long endure. For many years, international leaders have been conducting conferences and meetings, presumably in efforts to halt the insane, irrational, immoral, suicidal condition that threatens with extinction all living organisms. But in a larger sense, they cannot obliterate, they cannot eradicate, they cannot save us from the ultimate folly of nuclear war. The courageous, selfless, consecrated persons, living and dead, who over the years struggled, bled, and died in the pursuit of peaceful solutions to international understandings are the only ones who can show us the way to save ourselves from the extinction. The world's people seldom note nor long remember the unspeakable horrors of the past wars, but they will not survive an atomic holocaust. It is for those of us now living to dedicate ourselves completely to the unfinished task which peacemakers, living and dead, thus far so nobly advanced. It is for those of us who for so long have buried our heads in the sands to be here dedicated to the great unfinished task remaining before us, that this nation and the entire world under God shall at last emerge from the scourge of war, and that the government of the military, by the military, and for the military shall vanish from the earth. Thank you.
I think that poem tells it all for today's situation. I now call upon the author of another poem, especially written for this occasion, a farm woman from War Road, Minnesota, who has been an activist for years and is a person of great sensitivity and depth. I call upon Tanya Hemmingson.
In the 1770s, Tom Paine said, "These are times to try a man's soul." Well, these are times to try all our men's soul. When I say men, I mean women too. But there is one thing that is happening now that works to the good. I've always said every generation has its own terrors. But now we have a unique situation where all of us of every generation is facing the same terror of the bomb, so that all of us, young, old, men, women, every nation, every race, must fight for peace, or else we all die together, and we will not allow that to happen. Clarence, I'm very honored, very happy to be able to read this poem for your occasion. But remember, I want to promise that 10 years from now, when you are 100 years, you want me to read another poem
for you.
It's the 80s, and time for a big change. There is an anger in our land. I can see it swelling. I can hear it growing. You can see it in the eyes, angry mouths, a seething anger. Men and women, and oh, the young, an anger hardly contained, ready to explode, hunger and despair. But now the fight back swells. Listen, can you hear it? Tramp, tramp, tramp. Can you hear the marching feet? This is not the 30s. Listen, you in power. Long ago, Carl Sandburg said, the people. Yes, the people. What about the people? And now the people are asking, yes, what about us? No more stillness, no more silently starving through false pride. There is money. There are funds. If funds are there for bombs and killing, they're there for life. We will march. We will demand the right to live with a decent job. Able-bodied don't want relief. We want jobs. We want food we can afford. We want decent homes and heat and light. Listen to the marching feet. Tramp, tramp, tramp by the millions. Old people demanding a decent life for themselves. Workers demanding factories be reopened, run by the government if need be. Farmers demanding decent prices for the product. Marching feet, tramp, 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 against nuclear plants endangering us, against pollution. There is an anger in our land. There are questions that must be answered. But above all else, there is a fear of war. Above all else, we must have peace. The people know there must be peace, or there will be pieces. No amount of propaganda can still the native intelligence. No radio talks, no TV speeches. They know a nuclear war means the end of life. The people that we speak of, the people that speak of limited nuclear war, the people that don't know. But the people want peace. It's the 80s. Time for a big change. Time for the people to march and talk and act and force our government to start anew for the people. There is an anger in our land.
We will now hear from a professional folk singer, and probably known to many of you through the radio. He sometimes appears Saturday nights on the Prairie Home Companion program. It's also known as the Garrison Keillor Show. If you don't mind a plug, I don't think he does, he is appearing in a concert at the Landmark Center in St. Paul on September 12th, 8:30 p.m. We're very happy to have Charlie McGuire with us and to sing at this time.
Hi, folks. I'm glad to be here. I was born and raised on a farm, and this is how it is.
Getting in the cow, shoe them in the barn, put them in the stanchion, turn the radio on. Milk them all dry, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in. A month on the dairy for the check to come in. Well, I start my day in the sun up dark, I'm going down a lane to bring my milk cows up. I got a whole Savannah jersey and a one-eyed steer. An old brown cow jumps fences like a deer. Dew's on the ground and my feet all wet. I got a light in my hand, hat on my head. Down to the pasture to get my herd, just chewing their cud and looking at the birds. Oh, getting in the cow, shoe them in the barn. Put them in the stanch and turn the radio on. Milk them all dry, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in. A month on the dairy for the check to come in. Oh, well, get up, you cows, and I get them on the move. Their udders are swinging like water in balloons. I go up to the barn and I know their place with the lead one first, and I close the gate. Bring the cart around, give them all some feed. They lick their nose, flap theirs at me. I put on the machine and it feels so good to let down their milk like a good cow should. Getting in the cow, shoe them in the barn. Put them in a stanch and turn the radio on. Milk them all dry, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in. A month on the dairy for the check to come in. You know what tourists say, a cow's face is so fine. But I see their back ends most of the time. Sweat all summer to put hay in the mouth. The work all winter to feed it to the cow. Well, the milk is all done, I got the weather report. I got my day all planned for my job of work. Back to the pasture goes part of my life. Now I'm going in the house and I hug my wife. Getting in the cow, shoe them in the barn. Put them in the stanch, turn the radio on. Milk them all dry, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in. Getting in the cow, shoe them in the barn. Put them in the stanch, turn the radio on. Milk them all dry, send them out again. Wait a month on the dairy for the check to come in.
This is a traditional song. Well, how do I know that my youth is all spent? My get up and go has got up and went. But in spite of it all, I'm able to grin and think of the places my get up has been. Well, old age is golden, and so I've heard said. But sometimes I wonder as I crawl into bed, with my ears in a drawer, my teeth in a cup, my eyes on the table until I wake up. As sleep dims my vision, I say to myself, is there anything else I should lay on the shelf? But though nations are warring and business is vexed, I think I'll stick around to see what happens next. How do I know that my youth is all spent? My get up and go has got up and went. But in spite of it all, I'm able to grin and think of the places my get up has been. When I was young, my slippers were red. I could kick my heels right over my head. Now I am older, my slippers are blue, but still I could dance the whole night through. Well, now I am old and my slippers are black. I huff to the store and I huff my way back. But never you mind, I don't mind at all, 'cause I'd rather be huffin' than not huff at all. How do I know that my youth is all spent? My get up and go has got up and went. But in spite of it all, I'm able to grin and think of the places my get up has been. Now I wake up each morning and I dust off my wits. I open the newspaper and read the old bits. And if I'm not there, I know I'm not dead. So I eat a good breakfast and go back to bed. How do I know that my youth is all spent? My get up and go has got up and went. But in spite of it all, I'm able to grin and think of the places my get up has been.
top talent, I would say, and we'll hear some more. We're now going to hear a talk, and before introducing, I'm going to say, for reasons that no one has authorized other than myself, that I'm not even going to look at my watch. I talked with Professor Pratt just before coming in. He is doing a thorough research into farm uprising activities of the period of Clarence Sharp. And he has quite a bit to say, and I'm very anxious to hear it. And the ban is off, not completely, but it's off some. He is a professor from the University of Nebraska in Omaha. Has spent years of research of agrarian protest, specializing in the upper Midwest history sciences. Now, he has data that shows what I was up to, what Nat Witt and his wife were up to, what Alvina Hayman were up to, and they're all in this room. So he is of special interest to us, and I introduce Professor Bill Pratt.
Well, as a historian, I want to say that I'm delighted to be in a room full of so many people who've made so much history. But today, we're gathered together to honor a man who's devoted his life to improving the lives of farmers and other working people. And most of you know that most of Clarence Sharp's activity has been in this region, in the region of Minnesota and the Dakotas. This, of course, has been a region which probably has the longest active tradition of agrarian protest in American history. This is a region which has witnessed the alliance and populist movements of the 1880s and 1890s. It's a region which has witnessed the socialism of the early 20th century. It has witnessed the Nonpartisan League of North Dakota, and that's spread into other states as well. And of course, it's witnessed the Minnesota Farmer Labor Party. And then in the 30s, the Farmers' Holiday, and as Jim Flowers has testified, the United Farmers League. And it has also had a strong presence within other organizations of progressive agrarian activity. The Farmers Union in North Dakota, Minnesota, South Dakota, has had from time to time some very progressive elements. And then you don't have to be reminded that this region also has seen a great deal of communist organization within farm protest. Well, I wanted to just list those things to sketch out a political and cultural context in which Clarence Sharp has worked for so much of his life. Clarence's father was a populist, and Clarence and his brother Ted learned socialism from farm hands who came in at harvest time, who brought with them socialist literature, often published by Charles Kerr, publishers in Chicago. And Clarence and his brother were Jimmy Higgins's back in the days before World War I. And Jimmy Higgins, or the Jimmy Higginses, and the Jenny Higginses were the people who did so much of the work to build the socialist movement. These were the people who handed out the leaflets, the people who got others to meetings, who set up the chairs, who took them down after the meeting, the people who often didn't get written up in the newspapers. Well, at the age of 15 or so, Clarence Sharp was a Jimmy Higgins. And he and his brother sold The Appeal to Reason, which was one of the most significant publications 20th century America has ever seen.
It was a socialist newspaper published in Girard, Kansas. It came out weekly, and it was used to organize socialists across the country. Upton Sinclair's The Jungle appeared in the pages of the Appeal to Reason in serial form. It was a folksy socialist newspaper. And so when you hear that Clarence Sharp was out hustling subs for the Appeal to Reason, I want you to know he was about some important work. I believe he told me his brother and he sold about 100 subs in Bristol, South Dakota in the 1906 era?
Six.
Clarence was a socialist farmer after that. And I want to note that there were a lot of socialist farmers in Middle America in those days. From Oklahoma, Kansas, even Nebraska, North Dakota, South Dakota, Minnesota. And within this socialist, or this farmer socialist movement, were many people who fought against American involvement in World War I. Clarence, who witnessed and participated in that struggle to keep the United States out of World War I. And he also saw some of the stunts that were directed against the people who struggled in such a way. Now, the Nonpartisan League was a very impressive experiment in farmer organization in an attempt to take some ideas that were socialist and implement them at the state level. And what they did with the Nonpartisan League, socialists and people who were close to them, they went into the Republican primary and took over the Republican Party in North Dakota. Well, that approach was tried elsewhere in the region. A man named Arthur Townley, who learned a lot of his organization skills as a socialist, often given credit for the organizational schemes of the Nonpartisan League. He didn't do it alone, and we often forget that. There are many other people who make a movement than the man who has the official title. This Townley, and a lot of what I know about Arthur Townley, I've learned from Clarence Sharp, is a colorful person. Some people might think a bit crooked. He allegedly said on one occasion, if you put a lawyer, a banker, and an industrialist in a barrel and roll it down a hill, there'll always be a son of a bitch on top. Years later, somebody went, a man by the name of Bruce Nelson was writing a history in North Dakota, and he looked up Townley and he asked him about it. Townley said, well, he didn't remember saying it, but put it in the book anyway. In the northern section of South Dakota, there was a considerable amount of organizational effort to have Nonpartisan League there too. And what they would do is they'd send out an organizer and they would have him ride around with a local farmer. So that person would make contacts with local farmers. Well, Clarence Sharp would ride with Nonpartisan League organizers in South Dakota. This Nonpartisan League is part of the background, part of the story of the Farmer Labor Party in Minnesota.